Well, I sure am glad to be here. Rain or no rain. You all sure do make a tremendous audience. You listen so well, and you encourage the speaker so much. And you know, old preachers need encouragement too. Ecclesiastes. Blaise Pascal, a brilliant 17th century French mathematician who had so many insights of a spiritual sort, said about Ecclesiastes that there's enough brightness in it to illuminate the saints and enough obscurity to humble them. Well, I'm humbled when I study the book, because I will tell you for sure that a lot in it I don't understand. Now, some complained about yesterday. Are you hearing me in the back? Am I obscure back there? Anyway, okay. Because some said they were not hearing me in the back, and I decided I'd have to change my ways and I have to move the mic in order to be sure that you do hear. That's a frustrating thing, to listen and not be able to understand what's being said. Thomas Wolfe, who is a very well-known writer and novelist, said that this is the greatest piece of literature in the world. And I'm not sure that's right, but it sort of brings to mind that when we deal with the scripture, we're dealing with tremendously great literature. Aside from the issue of it being inspired of God, which it is, men have to say that these are remarkable writings, and we live sometimes so close to it that we lose that sense of the marvel of it, that it probes the depths of the human spirit. And we are privileged as God's children to have been brought to understand so much of it, to be transformed because of it. And we need to go out and talk to other people about Jesus. I said I'd say Jesus for some young friend. She's keeping a record of how many times I say what I say, and she had made a mistake and she had put a mark there. And so I said, I'm going to say Jesus for you. It'll be right when you turn it in. But we ought to be out there boldly saying, we serve a great God who has said things that nobody else has said. In fact, no human being or group of human beings would have ever dreamed of writing a book like this and telling a story like this. This is the reason I know that the gospel is true, because it's too incredible to be false. Human beings just never would have sent the Son of God into the world as this humble carpenter and all that kind of thing. That's just absolutely, tremendously outside our way of thinking. And so he shocked us, didn't he? And we needed to be shocked. But Ecclesiastes is a tremendous book. Ecclesiastes. That's from the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, from the Septuagint. And you recognize in that term, of course, ecclesia, which, as we have been taught, if we don't know much Greek at all, most of us figured out that that is the Greek word which is translated church in the New Testament. And, of course, in this case, it's talking about a man who calls an assembly together, the master of an assembly. That's who the preacher is. I don't know how formal this sort of situation is, as we read it. He is interested in teaching us something. He has a burden on him. I believe, as I said yesterday, it is Solomon. I didn't make this point, and I'm going to make it now. That if Solomon was not restored to God, it's the only case of an apostate writing three books of the Old Testament. Now, that doesn't prove anything, but it sure does make you think. We don't know of any other apostate who ever wrote by inspiration in the scripture, and especially this much. Well, I've already made my case there. Yesterday we talked about the fact that the perspective of the preacher is under the sun, things under the sun, beneath the heaven. He's talking about the material creation And when he asked the question, does a man have any profit for all his labor under the sun? And he says, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He means that. He started out with that statement, and he ends up with that statement, and that's how it is. Some people looking at the book said, now, it was just bleak cynicism and despair until somebody appended this section in the 12th chapter to it so as to deliver it from its sense of despair and emptiness. And that's not true. If you think that this is the first time in the 12th chapter that the Solomon ever said, fear God and keep his commandments, he said, fear God all through the book. He said, that's the answer all through the book. So this is not something that somebody appended to it. But that's his vantage point. And here's the question. Is there anything under the sun that you can build your life on that's worth everything, that's transcendent? That's the purpose of what God has done. Is there anything under the sun that will satisfy that? And Solomon says, nothing. And he said, I know. If you look at the world, and we talked about this yesterday, the natural cycles in the first 11 verses, the natural cycles just going on and on and on, going nowhere. You cannot investigate them or look at them and think about them and find any purpose for life in that. And then the kind of experiences we have as human beings, chapter 3, a time for this and that, and always a jarring contradiction, life, death, laughter and sorrow, and all, he goes through all those there, a very powerful poetic section. And he said, after you get through with it, although you've got eternity in your heart and you want to know the answer, and God put eternity in your heart and you need to know the answer, and it may be true that God makes all things beautiful in their times, and that is true, but you can't figure it out. And we took time to look at some of the statements that he made about injustice. But the righteous receive the reward of the wicked receive the reward of the righteous. And the question is, can we look at circumstances down here and see justice done at last, final justice accomplished? No, you cannot, because it is not. And there are a lot of specific cases in our lives and experiences that we are going to look at and be baffled by. How could God let that happen? And the answer to that is because he's a lot wiser than we are, and he will work it out. We're in a narrow veil of experience. I cannot tell you how wise God is. He is wise and knowledgeable beyond our power to comprehend. I think we know our own fallibility. I think we know our own finiteness. But we need to know that when we come to the time when we feel like judging God, because Job found out that that doesn't work, and we will find that out too. And that's sort of where we left it yesterday. And you say, well, that doesn't sound very comforting. Well, you know, that's comforting to a lot of people. I just finished teaching Ecclesiastes in Vacation Bible School adult class. And if you have any interest in the study guide, well, I'll be glad that you get a copy of it. But there was a sister who's had all kinds of problems sitting around on the front seat. And I wondered how she'd be taking it. I mean, she's got disease, and she's a young mother, and she has a lot of children, but she has her own, and she had to take on some other children because of the death in her family. And she just has a difficult time. And she's homeschooling. And she said to me afterwards, she said, I am so comforted by this. Maybe she'd been struggling to find the answer to why she had to have all these problems. And she hadn't found any answer. And perhaps she thought, there's something wrong with me that I can't see through this mystery of why things are happening this way. And perhaps if she was comforted because she was released from the need to do that. I had an old teacher. He actually substituted. He hadn't been in class in my college days a lot. He was teaching Romans, replacing somebody else. And I'll never forget what he said about something. He said, I don't know. He said, I don't need to know. And then his final statement was, I thank God I don't need to know. And I believe that message is here in Ecclesiastes. You don't need to know. He knows. And he'll work it out. And at last, we're going to look back on what looked like a most broken and circuitous route that we've taken through life and other people have taken through life And we're going to say, you know, he did it just right. People say, I'm going to have a lot of questions to ask when I get up there. Listen, when you get up there, you won't have any questions to ask, but it won't mean a hill of beans. It won't matter then. It will not matter then.
Okay, so let's trust him.
Now let me begin back in the first chapter again as we trace Solomon's experiment with life to try to find the ultimate meaning of things, something that you can build your life on. Verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. We've already noted that in other passages that this is the burden. Here we don't know, but we need to know. We've got the questions, but not the answers. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. By wisdom he sought to figure things out. He's talking about human wisdom. He's talking here about practical wisdom, probably. Men have been trying that for years. The philosophers have been saying to themselves, we can get the answer. We can get the answer. And if we don't get the answer of this generation, then the people that come after us, they're going to get the answer. It's always like a mirage out there receding, and it's about to come. We're about to get it. I read a little book called The History, A Brief History of Time. It was written by a very brilliant British astrophysicist who cannot move except by the use of his breath. I mean, he is absolutely almost totally without the ability to control his body. But he wrote that book, and he said near the end, he said, we are going to be able to know the mind of God. No, they won't. Because nobody can know the thoughts of a man except the spirit of man is in him. Even so, the only one that knows the thoughts of God, the spirit of God, as Paul writes in the second chapter of 1 Corinthians. You cannot know the mind of God unless he tells you. He will be the hero. I'm sorry. You're not going to be the hero because you have investigated and studied and by your own sagacity you figured this thing out. You're not going to be the hero. God's always going to be the hero. Let me tell you, I know my wife pretty well, but she surprised me quite regularly. And I figured out I don't know what she's thinking until I ask her. And we need to have that humble spirit about God. He has spoken to us, as we studied last night. He has spoken to us. He's told us his heart. He's opened himself up to us. But that's the only way we're going to know. But if we know it that way, we're going to have to be the humble recipients who have to say, I never thought about it that way. I never heard such a thing in my life. I am so shocked by this, but I know it is the truth. It will not increase your ego. It won't increase the ego of man. The only way you can come to know God is by humbling yourself beneath his mighty hand. So he failed in that. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is a grasping for the wind. Now, I don't think he's saying here, I pursued madness and folly. He's trying to say, he is saying, that I searched the difference. I searched by wisdom to know what was wisdom and what was madness and folly, and found out, verse 18, in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. I found out in this life, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And with regard to the search of man by his own unaided wisdom to know these great truths, the more he searches, the more he realizes, I'm not going to get it. I'm always amused at the confidence of philosophers that we're going to get the answer. We just keep working on it. And I said to myself, all we are is manure for the next generation. I mean, this is not a happy kind of destiny. We just do our thing and we don't ever learn the answer. And the next generation, they do their thing, they don't ever get the answer. And they keep passing the baton to somebody else. And God is standing here, I got the answer. Here's the answer. But you know why we don't accept that? Because we are so proud. We're like a two-year-old child. I can do it for myself. Feed them oatmeal and it'll be on the floor and the walls and the ceiling. But they can do it for themselves. They don't need any help. And we sit down here and think, we don't need any help. Never in this wide world have there been such a needy and dependent group of people than human beings. When we are born, we don't even have the ability to interpret us. As soon as he's born, doesn't know his mother, his father, and jumps in the water and swims off. But here we are down here. We have to be carefully nurtured in the early days, and somebody else is taking care of us. And we get to our adult life and say, I don't need anybody. That's all you've done since you came into this world is need somebody. We need somebody. And we need, above all, we need God. And we're not going to make it without him. Every breath we draw comes because of him. And so, humility of spirit is in order. Solomon found out that by his own unaided wisdom, all he got was frustration. Vanity of vanities. Well, he tried something else then. I said in my heart, chapter 2 begins, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. But surely this also was vanity. He gives us the conclusion before he tells us what he did. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do unto heaven all the days of their lives. Search for meaning in pleasure. Now that sounds kind of dumb, but people are still doing it. I mean, they want to party all the time, and after a while, their partying kind of looks like an effort to escape from boredom and meaninglessness. I want to ask a question here. He says, I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom. With practical skill. Now, I'm saying all that to say that this may not be somebody on a frenzied sexual orgy or an orgy of pleasure in any other direction that is mindless. It could be. I see a lot of that. And I don't think they're having a very good time. I think some of these parties are just intended to narcotize us from the pain. And there's an end to it after all. After a while, partying doesn't mean a thing. So don't look out at other people who seem to have it all and you think they're having a great time. I want to tell you something. We are, of all people as Christians, though, they're not having a good time. It's not possible for them to do it. And don't ever be envious. Be compassionate. These people need God. And don't ever hesitate to talk to them about it. I don't care how well seem to be doing and how complete their lives might appear to be. Beneath the surface, the truth is they are not right. And they are not happy. And we need to have that confidence. He says that I tried out all the pleasure and searched my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine. I'm not sure he's saying here, I was drinking myself into a drunken stupor. I'm not sure that that's the idea. I'm not even sure that wine in this particular case is a drug. In the latter part of the book, he says in verse 7, the ninth chapter in verse 7, go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart. You know, Hebrew said the same thing with different words. It's bread in the first one with joy, and it's wine the second with a merry heart. He's talking about food. Food that the children eat at the table too. For God's already accepted your work. So I'm not sure that what we're reading here is that Solomon just decided that he was going to really put one, tie one on. I can see Solomon say, I'm going to enjoy the good things in life. I'm going to go to the best restaurants where they have all the wonderful food you can imagine, and I'm going to go to the finest places, and I'm going to visit all the great cities, and I'm going to look at all the art treasures of the world, and I'm just going to have a great time investigating all this, and I'm just going to fill myself full of it. Let me tell you, it's possible to lose your soul in things that are not intrinsically immoral. That's the story here. And do we face a problem? Yes, we do, because we live in such a society of wealth that we can be easily seduced by these things. Because we have some power, not what Solomon had now. Forget that. But we have some power to go out and really enjoy ourselves. And you can be seduced by these temporary enjoyments. And we may as well face the fact that they do have their attractions. And they can be joyful. In fact, we're going to read in this book that that is so. And it's not necessarily bad unless you try to make that your God. Unless that becomes the purpose of your life. That is the danger that Solomon is talking about. All these things are not necessarily bad in themselves. And he will tell us before he's through that wisdom is not bad. Better to be wise than a fool. But if you take the wisdom or the practical skills of this life and try to imagine that this is going to be the answer to everything, then it becomes poison. And pleasure, if you pursue it as the whole of life, if you pursue it as the foundation for your being, then it will turn to poison. You see what I'm suggesting? You'll have to read the book and evaluate whether you see this as what's being said in Ecclesiastes, but I see this as the clear statement of Solomon that he's taking these things and one by one he's eliminating them as vanity of vanities. But I'm not to conclude, as we will talk about tomorrow, that everything is bad per se. And that's the reason I'm suggesting to you here that he may have been guiding himself with practical skill as he went after all these pleasurable things. Well, first it's perspicacity. I'll use Brother D's word. Well, wisdom. And then it's pleasure. And now it's possessions. More than possessions. This is more than possessions. This man is at work. Listen now. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had great possessions of herds and flocks, greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. Do you get that my in there? I built myself. I made myself. Well, I want to tell you, don't you enjoy making things? Don't you enjoy planting something? Don't you enjoy having... Well, I tell you, there's considerable pleasure in that. And it will last just as long as the project. And then it will be over. I think that's what Solomon found out. He enjoyed what he was doing. And again, that's not bad. Unless, as Solomon was doing, you're out there trying to find the answer. And you think, this will be the answer. I love painting, you may say. I couldn't paint anything. I'm a poet in my heart, but I can't get it to come out to save my life. But you know, I think about people who enjoy writing, and I think about people who enjoy fine art and they enjoy painting, or people who enjoy building things. I'm a woodworker of sorts, and of the worst sort, probably, but I enjoy it even in my own haphazard way. But I see men who build these fine things, and I see, there's a brother down in Nacogdoches, Texas, who is a pharmacist of all things, but he is a man who loves flowers, and he made his yard into an absolute explosion of beauty of all kinds of flowers he's put together, and they're so wonderfully arranged, and he enjoys that. But unlike Solomon, he knows that's not it. And when you have built your gardens and made your water pools and planted your fruit trees, and then it's over, so is the pleasure. This next verse in verse 8, I also gathered for myself silver and gold and a special treasure of kings and of provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men. Now, there's another translation of the delights of the sons of men, concubines. And someone said that's just a sort of a pleasant way to say concubine. If that is the case, and it could be the case, because he had 300 and 700 wives, You know, I've thought about that. How would the man visit them once a year? You'd have to just, well, this is not your year. But I'll be there next year. How long are you going to be there? Well, I think I've mapped out about 12 hours. I'll be able to, well, maybe six. I'll be able to see. This is incredible. In the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon will say, I have found one good man in 1,000 and no woman. Well, what do you expect? Now, I believe what Solomon did was to make his wives his God. And you say, well, he had 1,000. That was his problem. Well, the same problem can exist when there is just one wife or one husband. If you try to make that your God, you follow what I'm saying? If you try to make marriage and your marriage mate the whole purpose of life and your God, it will not sustain the load. Your wife can't do that for you, and your husband can't do that for you. There's a book that I read some years ago. I was always interested in C.S. Lewis. I got interested in C.S. Lewis 1956-7 when I was in the library in Waukegan, Illinois, and ran across one of his books, just a happenstance, and was rather captivated by his approach to things. Unfortunately, C.S. didn't get it. Died in high caste Anglican, thought there was such a place as purgatory, didn't have as high a view of scripture as he should have. I mean, he wouldn't. It wouldn't have bothered C.S. to find there's a mistake in the text, the original text for that matter. But he said a lot of good things, and I just want to say this to the young men that are here: take the wheat and leave the chaff. Don't let any writer ever dominate you except the Holy Spirit in this book. Take the wheat, lead the chaff. I mean, brethren read Barnes for years, and we knew he wasn't a Christian. We took the wheat and left the chaff. And there were other writers that were very influential on brethren 50, 60, 70 years ago. But I see today a disposition to get caught up with some men who are writing until you're just carried away with everything they have to say, and their styles sometimes are not consonant with the kind of preaching that needs to be done. They don't stay with the text. That's all free. I'm all set to do that. But this man that wrote this book is a friend of C.S. Lewis. Look at this. Is that a rabbit? That's a rabbit. That's in-house yoga. Brother Bowman was telling us about all the rabbits you can chase. You know, they jump up and then the tongue just expands. Maybe Sewell said that too. I don't know. But anyway, this man and his wife decided in a very pagan way that they were going to mean everything to each other. Sheldon Van Auken was the name of the writer. And the title of the book was A Severe Mercy. And so he and Davy just had this glorious time in the early days of their marriage, and they were just everything to each other until one day Davy came home with some interest in religion and started talking about that, and Sheldon said, I was very upset by it because we had agreed that we were going to be everything to each other, and now a third party has been brought in here. And he was resistant of that idea and resented it until finally, because Davy was interested, he was willing, he said, to let this idea come in. But he said then it was Davy and God. He's just after the conjunction there, and God. And then Davy became ill with cancer. And one of life's great painful realities came home. And he began to think about God. He began to think about God a lot. Isn't it tragic that those sorts of things are the things that have to happen before we come to our senses? Well, maybe it's not a tragedy. If that's what it takes. Anyway. Then he said, as he concluded his story, because David died, he said, finally in my life, it was God and David. God became first. And I say all that, and that's the reason the book was called A Severe Mercy. It took this very painful loss before he would come to recognize that God was everything. I say all that to help us realize that even the most happy blessing that God has given to us, and marriage is a blessing, my. Outside of our relationship to God through Jesus Christ, I think of it as one of the greatest blessings that human beings have. And it came down from God, and every good and perfect gift comes from above. But that, you can't make marriage God. You can't do that. And if you do that, you will destroy it. You will destroy it because that relationship cannot sustain that kind of burden. And I believe that's what Solomon's undoing was. So I became great, verse 9 says, more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. I want you to remember that. He's saying, I exercised the greatest prudence as I made this search. I didn't go into it just in a wild, undisciplined way. I disciplined myself. I thought my way through this. I made all the provisions. And I'm telling you with all my wisdom, with all my forethought, with all my planning, this thing went to nothing. Vanity of vanity. All is vanity. So, verse 10, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity and a grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. Oh, that's a sad, sad story, don't you think? He is pried so mightily to get the answer and then finds none. Then he sort of reaches to a conclusion here. Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Good question. Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head. He looks, he sees, he perceives. But the fool walks in darkness, yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. You can be just as wise as you want to be, and you're going to die just like a fool. Is that true under the sun? That's true under the sun. And sometimes the fool will live 100 years, and you're going to live 30. Equity is not here. These jarring contradictions, if there is a God in heaven who is wise and gracious, Solomon wrestles with. So I said in my heart, verse 15, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? What good did it do? Why did I waste my time with all that wisdom in view of the fact the same thing happened to me as it will happen to a fool? There is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As a fool. Therefore I hated life, he says, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, and all is vanity and grasping for the wind. When he was doing all that great work, he was having a great, that pleasurable thing, but that's all gone now, and he thinks about how it's not going to make any difference anyway, what I've done. And verse 19, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, the man that comes after me. I think we might think about that a bit. We do all this great work. I think about these people who think of this as our house, this is my house. Well, it's not your house. You are a temporary resident. If anybody lived in a house before you, it's not your house. It was their house, too. It's not your house, you say. It's not your house. You go in there and redecorate the place and make it yours and fix it up with the furniture you want and put the colors on the wall and the wallpaper in and everything just like you want. And then you're going to die and somebody else is going to tear the whole thing apart and say, what fool did this? This is incredible. I've never seen such ugliness in all my life. And all your books that you have treasured and loved so much, and you've taken care of them. You didn't throw them around and bend them in the wrong, and somebody going to get a hold of them and dog-ear all the pages and maybe throw them out.
Turn to the garbage.
You don't know who's going to come after you. And that was one of Solomon's great distresses. He would do all this work, and then somebody would come after him who had no sense whatsoever, no appreciation of what he had done. Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful, and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. You got to remember, though, this is a man who hadn't looked over the sun yet. And he's wrestling to find something here, inside himself and in this world where he lives. And he's empty. I'm stressing this fact because you need to know that the people out there that don't know Christ, they're empty too. And a lot of these people that are involved in all this superficial kind of religion, they're empty. And I'm thinking we've got a problem here. I'm thinking that we look out at those people and we say to myself, well, they seem to be so content. Why should I disturb their happy life by coming here and telling them that they're going to hell? Why should I do that? Why should I disturb them by telling them that unless they follow Jesus Christ, there's no hope? Why should I do that? They're content. And you know, things are running well, and I'll be the disturber of the peace of people. Jesus is the disturber of the peace of people. Because they're not peaceful, because they're not fulfilled, because they're not happy. They are not at peace. They know no joy. And if we don't know that, if we don't get a full conviction of that, we are not going to seek the lost, because we're not quite sure they're lost. Another thing that worries me is that if we're not interested in sharing what we have with others, maybe it doesn't mean that much to us. Maybe it has not helped us that much. Maybe we have not found any peace and joy in Christ. And that's the reason we don't share it with others. I'll tell you, if somebody has found something that changed his or her life, they're bound to talk about it. I met a lady in Tucson, Arizona, who thought that cod liver oil was the answer to arthritis, and you couldn't stop her from talking about cod liver oil. If you winced one little bit, if you showed one sign of pain, she's over there talking about cod liver oil. My point is this, that what we talk about or we do not talk about reveals a great deal about us. We need to see the despair of people that are lost. We need to see what Solomon is saying here. I was empty. I was filled with despair and despondency. The joy went out of me. My life turned to dust. And then he concludes. Nothing is better than a man for a man than that he should drink, eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? Another translation of that Hebrew, which is a little uncertain, there is without God or without him. And either one to be true. Nobody could enjoy more than Solomon did, and his experiment is the final word. And nobody can, it's also true to say that nobody can eat and have enjoyment in this world without God. The joy goes out of things where there is joy without God. So that everything is influenced adversely because God is not in the picture. For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God This also is a vanity and grasping for the wind. I'm not sure about that verse. I'm not sure that he's saying that it's going to happen in this life, that what the sinner gathers is going to be given to the righteous. I'm not sure that he said in this book that that happens in this life. Anyway, you can tell me what you think about that verse. I'll just pass on. There are things in this book I'm still wrestling with. There's no satisfaction in things. There's no satisfaction in pleasure. There's no satisfaction in human wisdom. It's not going to come. I've always been influenced in the chapter 5 where he says in verse 10, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. Or he who loves abundance with increase. He ought to know. I'll tell you something about things. You know, your heart's desire might be one of these big red pickups. I've never seen the like of pickup. There's more in those things than the finest Cadillac you could buy. Pickup. A four-wheel drive vehicle and sometimes got dual wheels on the back, and you wouldn't take it off the interstate. I'm not taking it over there, over those roads. Got four-wheel drive in there, down here in the south where the snow's every now and then, but not very many times. Got to have that four-wheel drive vehicle. I'm being cynical. It's an old man talking, you know. If I was a young man, I'd be buying one, probably. But a pickup is the living in now. Pickup. I used to talk about Cadillac. That's nothing now. Not even a Beamer. Well, maybe we'd get that. But, you know, you get one of them. Oh, my, this is wonderful. Oh, I got one. And then you get two. And you say, hey, listen, we're really living now. And then you get three. And then you get four. And you get five. Now, what's that? It's boring. Boring to the core. And that's the way all things are. Momentary. Momentary in their existence and momentary in their satisfaction or giving any enjoyment. When goods increase, he said, they increase who eat them. So Murphy's Law is, what is it? Expenses rise to meet income. I don't know. But he said, as you get more, you got more to spend it on. So then he just says this about the whole business. In verse 12, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet. He just has to work every day, and he's so tired when he gets in that bed, man, he just goes to sleep. Gets up the next day and works out the day. He needs that. He's got enough to get more pinto beans and cornbread for the next time. And then he goes to bed because he's dead tired. But the rich man, he's got all those things to worry about. And he's got to hold on to what he's got. And when he goes to bed, he can't sleep. Things don't bring you any happiness. They bring burdensome responsibility. And so there is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for the owner to his hurt. But those riches perish with misfortune. You can lose every dime you've got. But see, I've got the insurance company. Insurance companies go broke. Nations collapse. The economies of the world collapse. They have collapsed before, and they can collapse again. There's no certitude about that. Oh, no. Oh, no. We've got the Fed up there taking care of things. They're going to head that off. They're going to take care of any kind of untoward direction for all the markets. And you know, the insurance company's going to be protected because we've got the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. That's going to take care of that, up to $100,000 for every deposit you make or for every account you've got. So we don't have to worry about that. Listen, that can all go. We have no idea how fragile life is. Don't build your life on that. Ask yourself, How you'd feel about yourself and your own sense of worth if you lost everything you had? Would there be anything left of you? Or are you what you have? That's a probing thought for me. But those riches perish through misfortune, and when he begets a son, there's nothing in his hand. You don't worry about giving your children money. Steel magnate Pittsburgh, his name escapes me, built a bunch of libraries in this country. You know his name. He said he'd rather give poison to his children than money. Of course, he was a kind of tight Scotsman. But nonetheless, that's exactly right. The heritage you want to give your children needs to be imperishable. The faith of our Lord Jesus Christ. Nobody can take that away from them. They can lose the other. And you can lose it. And here's something that Job said a long time ago. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand under the sun. Is that so? I'm not sure we believe it. No, we know that. I want to say what I've said frequently. A lot in the Bible is not a matter of revelation. We know it already. We know good and well we're not going to take anything with us when we die. We know that. But we don't live like we know it. We live like it's a dream. It's not true. But it's going to happen. You're going to leave all this behind. And the question is, what can you carry with you? I'll tell you what you can carry with you. Your relationship with God and who you are, and that cannot be taken away from you, not even by death itself. That lasts. And that's the very thing, if that's true, we ought to be building for. Let me ask this question, and then maybe I'll just be quiet for today. If you are conscious when the time for you to die comes, what do you suppose you will regret? Oh, my, you know. I sure am sorry that I didn't buy that car I'd always wanted. Oh, boy, we didn't get to buy our dream house. Oh, that just really breaks my heart. We didn't get to do that. And we didn't make it to Paris. I didn't get that fishing boat that I always wanted. And that, you know, when we... I had those dreams about sitting out on the lake after we retired and getting an ice. Not going to do that. My. You think we'll think about those things? Nobody thinks about those things. I think the most carnally minded soul on earth doesn't think about those things. What do you think about? You think about meeting God. Whether you're ready to. My conclusion is, if that's what we're going to think about when life is ending, shouldn't we think about that now? Isn't it folly not to think about that now? Does it make any sense not to think about that now? Think on these things. And we'll continue tomorrow. I thank you so much. You are good students. You just need a better teacher.